Before we dive in the message, I just want to remind you or maybe re-encourage you about something we've offered you. Obviously, journeying through the Gospel of Mark is good, you know, to do on Sundays, but we've made a way for you to journey with Jesus in a more substantial way than just showing up on Sunday mornings once a week. And that is, we put together a chronological reading of the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, that you find at the beginning of the New Testament. And so there's some things that Mark doesn't touch on that Jesus did that some of the other Gospels writers, they'll touch on. And so you get a bit of a fuller understanding of all the things that were happening in the life and ministry of Jesus and his disciples if you want to do that. And so there's like hard copies of those back at the information center, or you can go online to the sermon series each week. They're there digitally as well. You can download those also. Another thing I want to encourage you to do is... Well, maybe you knew this, maybe you didn't, but when Mark wrote the Gospel of Mark, when you open up your Bible and you're you know, reading through the Gospel of Mark, there's all these numbers among the words. There's some little numbers and some big numbers. We call the little numbers verses and the big number chapters. And but when Mark wrote the Gospel, he didn't write it with those verses and chapters. Those were added later. In fact, over 1,000 years after Mark wrote the Gospel, a guy came along in the 12th or 13th century and said, you know, it's kind of hard to find places, and so let's put some chapters in here to kind of break up some of the books. And then 200 years later in the 16th century, another guy came and said, we should put some verses in here to help us understand how to find things a little bit easier. But when Mark wrote it, he just wrote it like a story, like a novel. He said, here's the story of Jesus. And just like, you know, when you buy a novel, you don't, you know, open it up and you're like, I'm going to start at chapter 18, you know, and start halfway through the chapter, and then I'll go back to chapter 4 and read that and try and piece it together later. You start at the beginning and you read it to the end. And so I want to encourage you, if you would like to anyways, over the next, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 weeks, is to get the Gospel of Mark, and if you have an hour or two, sit down and just read it all at once. Like Mark probably intended it to be understood and read. Just read the story and say, God, what do you kind of bring out before me or to me from the Gospel of Mark? I'm not a very fast reader. I'm a faster talker than a reader. But I'm probably like average or maybe below average in reading and speed. And I read it fairly slowly, and it took me 1 hour, 2 minutes, and 24 seconds. So if you got an hour, hour and a half, just sit down and read it. Or maybe you travel a lot, get an audio Bible and just listen to the entire thing in one sitting and see what God tells you through the Gospel of Mark. You might find it interesting as well. Well, have you ever felt like you were just in a little deeper than maybe you wanted to be? Like you were in over your head and you were in a situation or a circumstance where you felt like you were completely inadequate to deal with that very circumstance or that very situation. And maybe sometimes you find yourself in a situation, maybe there's a prospect of something coming, right? And you know something's coming, or you've been asked to do something and you think, no, that's way more than I could ever do. And you feel this inadequate feeling of I'm in over my head. Maybe you took a job one time and you started, and like half an hour into your job, you're thinking, oh boy, this is more, like this is a steep learning curve, right? This is more than I can handle. And you just kind of get filled with this kind of anxiety. I remember I had this feeling the very first time I was ever asked to preach. I was in this church, and the senior pastor at the time, his name was Rod Masterson, and I was youth pastor, and he said, you know, Alvin, you want to preach sometime? And I, like, faster than he got the words out of his mouth, I said, no, that's not something I ever want to do, so don't ever ask me again. You know, I didn't say it quite that way, but those are some of the thoughts I had, and I said no, and for 2 years, he kept asking me, and I kept saying no, and I'm really thankful he was a patient guy and gracious, because had he pushed me, I probably would have quit and left, because I was so against, you know, preaching. It just wasn't something I ever wanted to do, and it freaked me out. It kind of scared me. But there's something interesting that happens in us, a bit of a dilemma, I would say, when someone asks us to do something that we feel inadequate to do. And it's a dilemma because on the one hand, when they ask us, we think, what? You actually think I could do that? And it kind of feels nice, right? Like, what? You think I could sing a solo? You know, I don't know. Or you think I could serve in that area of ministry? Or you think I could? No. Like, and so we have this dilemma because it feels nice. Like, wow, they actually think I could. But then there's our perspective. That's their perspective. There's our perspective. And it's kind of like, I just feel so inadequate. And we have this dilemma. What do we do? Do we listen to what they think and see it from their perspective and dive in? Or do we see it from our perspective? And this is the dilemma I had in the preaching thing, because I was like, wow, Rod, you actually think I could preach? And that was his perspective, and then mine was like, obviously not. And so I just chose to see it from my perspective. I saw him as someone who had lost his marbles and wasn't thinking clearly, and he obviously didn't know what was up and down. So I took it from my perspective and just kept saying no. Well, as we continue the story of Jesus through Mark, what we're going to see is Jesus, who does a lot of amazing things, and we've seen that already, at some point he comes along and he starts asking his disciples to do some things that, well, was just way above their expertise, way above their pay grade, and made them feel utterly inadequate, like they were in over their heads. Now, here's the thing about being in over your head, and maybe you've felt this too. It keeps life interesting, doesn't it? Like every time you're in over your head, if you're you know in that situation, it kind of keeps life interesting. You're probably not falling asleep. In fact, if you're in over your head, you're probably not sleeping at all because you're just like you're anxious. You're filled with this. Oh man! But it keeps life interesting. Mark Laurie one time he was asked to summarize the entire Christian life into one word. You know, if you could summarize the entire Christian life into one word, what word would you use? And he said, if I could summarize the entire Christian life, I'd say this word, interesting. The Christian life is interesting. And if you want a boring life, don't come to Christ. But if you want an interesting life, an exciting, engaging, and fascinating, inspiring life, come to Christ. And the reason is because when we follow Jesus, so often Jesus, God, in following him, he will ask us to take steps a little further than maybe we want to go. He's going to ask things of us that maybe make us uncomfortable, make us feel like we're in over our heads. And if you've ever read, you know, the Bible at all, you've seen there's just story after story of people that were asked to do a little bit more than probably they felt comfortable with. It's called faith. And faith keeps life interesting. And the reason Jesus does this is because following Jesus is not a spectator event. And so he didn't pull his disciples around him and said, hey, now watch me do stuff. Along the way, he said, well, I'm going to get you to do some stuff. And it's going to make you a little bit anxious at times and maybe feel like you're in over your head. But this isn't a spectator event. You didn't just join, you know, following Jesus to watch. And here's the thing about watching. Watching can put you to sleep. Now, just raise your hands in your heads. Don't do it, you know. But who here's fallen asleep watching something? Right? We've all fallen asleep watching stuff. Right? Maybe you were watching sports and you fell asleep, or you were watching a movie or Netflix and you fell asleep. Or, I mean, if you've ever watched golf, you know you've fallen asleep, right? Watching stuff, because watching stuff, it can put us to sleep. In fact, probably 15 or so years ago when Lord of the Rings came out, our family, some of us kids, we decided to take my parents to Lord of the Rings. Now, if you've seen Lord of the Rings, it's a pretty intense show. If you go to the one, you know, in the theater, it's like loud and booming and big screen and it's intense. And you're like, oh, I won't fall asleep in this. Well, we took my mom, and like less than 10 minutes into the show, she's just like, just out snoring. And she's just out. And then like partway through, she wakes up and she's like talking the whole time. Like, I don't get this. What's going on? I don't understand what's going on. And we left. We're like, what do you think? She's like, I just didn't get the movie. You know, she'd fallen asleep, because here's the thing. We fall asleep watching, but you know, following Jesus isn't a spectator event, and following Jesus will be interesting. It will be scary sometimes. It will require some steps of faith. But maybe you're here this morning and you think, well, I don't know if I want to follow Jesus because I kind of want a boring life. I don't want it to be interesting. I don't like to step out further than I'm comfortable. I just want a life of peace. Can I just have some peace? Well, what we're going to see at the end of the story we're going to look at today is, in fact, the peace you so desperately desire is in following Jesus, the very center of who he is. So far, Mark, we've traveled with Jesus and we've seen some pretty interesting things that probably wouldn't put you to sleep. You know, we've seen Jesus, he's preaching, he's healing the sick, he's casting out demons, he's calmed a storm, all in the first 5 chapters. So this has been pretty intense. On top of that, Jesus has had some pretty heated run-ins with the religious leaders, and he's claimed things like I'm over your rituals. In fact, I'm over the Torah law. I'm an authority over it, and these laws and rituals that these Pharisees have held and held closely, and the traditions that they've held onto, probably misrepresenting the law often. For hundreds of years, Jesus says I'm over them, and he just keeps building things. things on himself. It's been quite interesting. And then on top of that, he's hanging out with sinners and tax collectors and prostitutes and having parties with them. And everyone's like, who is this Jesus? It's been quite interesting. And then he pulled 12 disciples around himself. And because following Jesus isn't a spectator event, in chapter 6, the very beginning of chapter 6, and this will kind of just set the tone for the miracle that we're going to dive into in a little bit. But at the beginning of chapter 6, we see that calling the 12 around him, Jesus, he began to send them out two by two and gave them authority over impure spirits. So Jesus, because this isn't a spectator event, he pulls the 12. He says, don't just come and watch me. You're doing the ministry now. You go out. And they're thinking, well, what authority do we have? We're supposed to preach and we're supposed to teach and we're supposed to drive out, you know, heal the sick and drive out evil spirits. What authority? He says, my authority in my name. Now, here's the thing about Jesus. Jesus was very unique, and he keeps building the whole thing on himself. When Jesus called the 12 disciples, many rabbis in Jesus' time had disciples. But usually the way it worked is if you were a rabbi, people would come to you, disciples would come to you and say, hey, I like what you teach. Hey, I like what you're doing. Can I follow you? And can you teach me? Can I learn from you? Can I be your disciple? But Jesus was very different. He went out to people and say, you, come follow me. Hey, you with the nets over there, Peter, yeah, come follow me. He wasn't like any other rabbi. He didn't wait for people to come say, hey, can I follow you? He said, you're following me, come follow me. And then on top of that, we don't have any record really of rabbis in the first century or in Judaism who would send out disciples in their name. In fact, rabbis sometimes would go out and do mission trips or ministry, but they wouldn't send out their disciples to go do it for them. They would just go do it. And yet Jesus, he says, no, go out, but go out in my name. In my name, you have authority over the spirit realm. You have authority over the physical realm. And the disciples did. They go out and they're teaching and preaching and they're seeing miracles happen. They're casting out demons and they're healing the sick. And this is just an amazing time because up to this time, they've just watched Jesus do it. And suddenly they're saying, wait, the power is in us and through us. Jesus has given us authority. And this is a very, very exciting time. And so they do all this ministry. And I told you earlier in the series, Mark, he shares this kind of like they do this ministry. And then right before the miracle that we're going to look at, he ends the story of the ministry they were doing. But there's this section in your Bibles in chapter 6, and you can look at it. The story right in between, that's about the beheading of John the Baptist. Like, why would you put that between these two stories? But Mark often does this. He starts a story and then has another story and then finishes the story. It's like somehow they have this interrelatedness. Well, what does the beheading have to do with the ministry and all this? And we're not really sure. I mean, some think, well, maybe it's this picture of the cost of discipleship. You know, John the Baptist, kind of his life was taken because he wanted to do what was right for God. We don't know. But Mark does this. He starts this, Mark 6, verse 7. We see the disciples do this ministry. And then we jump to this. The apostles gathered around Jesus and reported to him all they had done and taught. I mean, this is a high point for the disciples, right? I mean, these fishermen and these, uneducated, and they have power, and they come to Jesus, and they're like, this is amazing. We saw demons flee, and we saw sick healed, and we preached in your name, and I'm sure at this point, Jesus is just grinning from ear to ear, right? He's just like, you got it. You get to be part of what I'm doing in the world. And I'm sure this was a really, really exciting time. And I'm sure the disciples, they're quite tired. In fact, it shows, the text tells us they probably are, because Jesus, a crowd starts forming, because crowds always form in Mark, wherever Jesus is. And a crowd starts forming. And Jesus says to his disciples, you guys need to get away. You need to get some rest. And so he sends them in the boat to go across the lake. And he says, I'll send the crowds away. But the crowds, the Sea of Galilee isn't very big. So they watch where the boat's going, and they just walk on the land, and they get there, and when the boat lands, they're all there, and the crowd's there, and Mark tells us Jesus has compassion on these people, and so he starts teaching them, and he doesn't just tell like one or two stories or one or two parables or just a little lesson. It kind of drags out. He's kind of long-winded, and they've been there for quite some time, and this is quite a large crowd already. In fact, later in the story, we'll find out it's 5,000 men, not including women and children. And we find out that by this time, it was late in the day. So the disciples came to Jesus, to him, and they said, this is a remote place. and it's already very late. Send the people away so that they can go to the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat. I think this is fairly bold on the disciples. They just tell Jesus what to do. And maybe they've gotten a little too confident in their ability to do ministry. I'm not sure. But they just decide, you know, we've been doing some ministry and we're tired. And Jesus, you're probably tired. And it's already late in the day and everyone's hungry. In fact, we're a little hangry. And so it's time for you, Jesus, just to send the people away. Because there's a lot of men here and there's some women and children. And there's just too many. Send the people away. And they tell Jesus what to do. But Jesus isn't really going to have a whole lot of what they think he should do. And so he does something very surprising. And Jesus answered them and said, you give them. You give them something to eat. And I'm sure at this point the disciples are laughing. They're thinking, okay, either he's very hungry, hungrier than we thought, or he's gone crazy. I don't know what you know, last week Pastor Bill said Jesus had a sense of humor. This is funny. Like 5,000 people in the middle of nowhere, and Jesus says, you give them something to eat. You do it. And the disciples do what most of us do when God asks us to do something that's, well, a little above our pay grade, a little above what we think we can do. Whenever God asks us to do something we think in our own minds, that's silly or that's ludicrous or that's just a little too far out there, the disciples do what we do when we're in that situation. And they think logically. That's what they do. They reason. And they make some excuses. And they said to him, that would take more than half a year's wage. Okay, so they're pretty smart guys. They do the math really quick. There's 5,000 men, and not including women and children. If we're, let's say, we'll $5, $6 to $8 per person. We can probably feed them for that amount of money times 5,000. Okay, that's $30,000 to $40,000. That's a good chunk of change. And so, you know, when Jesus puts something in their lap that's way above what they think they can do, they just think logically. And they start to reason. And what Jesus does here and what happens next is going to be so transformative for their lives that all four Gospels record this miracle of Jesus, and it's the only miracle that's in all four Gospels. This would impact how they view Christ, and it would impact how they view ministry from here on out forevermore. And they start thinking logically, and they start thinking this would be $30,000 to $40,000. And so they give their excuse, and they press into Jesus a little bit and say, here's why, Jesus, your idea is a very, very bad idea. But they do it in a nice way with a question. Are we to go and spend that much on bread and give it to them to eat? You know, there's a Mennonite in the crowd, right? One of the disciples was a Mennonite, or a Jew. Oh, they're all Jewish, I guess. So they're you know, one of them think, come on. Are we to spend 30 to 40, you know, equivalent of this much? Are we to, you know, this is, obviously they're telling Jesus, your idea is a bad idea. And they have their excuses, and it's a logical, reasonable excuse, isn't it? And Jesus, he asks them a question, then he tells them something to do. And this would transform them. And he said, well, how many loaves do you have? How many loaves do you have? He asks. That's the question. What do you have? And then he tells them to go do something. Now go and see. And I'm not sure exactly what this meant. You know, how many loaves do you have among the 12 of you? Did anyone pack a lunch? Come on. Or if Jesus was saying, there's 5,000 men here, there's some women and children too, and there's a big crowd. I mean, this is bigger than Three Hills times two, right? So it's a big crowd. Go around the crowd and see. I don't know what Jesus was meaning, but John, one of Jesus' disciples, he kind of fills in some blanks that Mark doesn't have here, and he tells that the disciples found a young boy who had 5 loaves and 2 fish, and so when they found out, they said, you know, we have 5 loaves and 2 fish. I'm not really sure how that worked, if the disciples are kind of walking through the crowd and they're like, hey, there's a boy there with his lunch, and you know, there's 12 of us and one of him, and so if we grab him, Peter, you grab his lunch. And you know, I'm not sure how it all worked, but they get the lunch and they come to Jesus and say, here's the best we could do. We got 5 loaves, we got 2 fish, and there's a lot of thousands of people here. here's the best we could do. And then Jesus directed them to have all the people sit down in groups on the grass. And they sat down in groups of hundreds and fifties. And taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish and looking up to heaven, he gave thanks and he broke the loaves. And then he gave them to his disciples to distribute to the people. He also divided the 2 fish among them all. Notice how Jesus, he's about to do a miracle. A God thing is the thing that was way above their pay grade that made them feel inadequate because honestly, they couldn't feed 5,000 people. And Jesus is about to do this miracle, but notice how Jesus keeps involving the disciples. You go have them sit down. Hey, you distribute the food. And even in their inadequacy, he involves them in the very miracle he's about to do. And they all ate. They all ate. Not like, okay, just a few of them ate. Okay, you know, just a nibble each because, you know, they all ate and were satisfied. No one left that hillside hungry. It wasn't, hey, add more water to the soup. We got to make it last. You know, we kind of ate, but we didn't. No, they all ate and they were all satisfied. If they wanted seconds, they had seconds. No one left hungry or dissatisfied. And then the miracle within the miracle. And the disciples picked up 12 basketfuls of broken pieces of bread and fish. The number of the men who had eaten was 5,000. And they picked up 12 basketfuls. Now, why is that important? Because there's 12 disciples. And Jesus had asked the 12 disciples to do something they would never be able to do. And when they left, they all left with a souvenir. A basket full of bread and fish. And I imagine they held on to their souvenir. And years later, when Jesus left and God asked them to do something that was just a little or maybe a lot beyond their capabilities, they went back to that basket and said, I guess he can do it. And I think they started to realize, and this had a big impact in their life in realizing that when we combine the very little that we have with the greatness of who God is, big things happen. Big things happen. See, the disciples never could have fed the crowd of 5,000 men, not including women and children, with 5 loaves and 2 fish. They were in over their heads. They were in water way too deep that they couldn't swim in. And they were inadequate to do that. And yet Jesus says, bring the little you have. Go and see. What can you bring up? I want to use it. He says, if you combine that with who I am, big things happen. You know, if the disciples were here today, they'd say, it hasn't changed. God still loves to take the little that we have. And when we combine it with the greatness of who he is, big things happen. It hasn't changed. God still does big things. Now, but here's what I realized about myself, and here's something I've learned about myself, and maybe this is true of you too. I imagine it probably is, but I'm a king. I am. Build me a throne, set me on it, because I'm a king. I am a king of excuses. You know, when God asks me and prompts me to do something that I'm like, oh, I don't know if I can do that, or I don't know if I can do a good job, I don't know. Pick someone else, God. I am the king of coming up with excuses. And like the disciples, you know, talking to Jesus and telling him all the reasons this is a bad idea, I'm that person. Here's all the reasons why I can't, God. Here's all the reasons why this won't work and why your idea is a bad idea. Now imagine telling God, the God of the universe who created the universe and holds it all from going into chaos, imagine telling that God his idea is a bad idea. I don't know if it'll fly, but here's the thing. I do it all the time. I tell God his idea is a bad idea. Now I told you earlier, the first time I was asked to preach, I said, no, it's a bad idea. Well, about 7 years later, after I'd preached maybe, you know, a handful or a dozen times, we had no senior pastor, and we were in a transition, and there was some talk progressing about me moving from youth pastor to lead pastor. And you can imagine how I responded to that idea. I had a lot of anxiety, and, well, I had a lot of excuses. I clearly remember one day driving down the road with my wife, Mandy, and we were thinking about this, and all of my anxiety about this process and taking this role, they all came out in this phrase, this sentence, and we just wrote it down right there because it was so true. I said this: I'm underexperienced, undereducated, underqualified, underconfident, and underaged. In my mind, this was a bad idea. I would later tell the elder board this, but I would add to this statement, I would say, but I'll do it as long as you keep me underpaid, understaffed, and undervacationed. And they never kept their end of the bargain, I guess. But you know, I'm the king of excuses. But here's the truth about my excuses. They were all true. They were all reasonable, and they were logical. You know, I was not experienced. I was underexperienced. I'd never been a lead pastor in my life. In fact, I'd never dreamt of being a lead pastor. In fact, when I was a young adult, I kind of vowed I would never be a pastor. I was underexperienced. I was undereducated. I didn't have my master's. Imagine that. And even more than that, I didn't even have a doctorate yet. Wait, which one comes first? Master's, the doc? See how undereducated I am? But considering we live in an educational town, where many of the professors that are doctors and have their masters attend this church, I am undereducated. I was underqualified. My experience in education showed that. I was also underconfident. You know, people would, today, they ask me often, so how's the ministry going as lead pastor? You've been at it for a few years, and how's it been? And I always tell them, better than I expected. They say, well, what do you mean? I said, I'm alive. I didn't think I'd make it this long. I'm underage. You know, at the time of the transition happened, our membership was a little older than it is now. We've added some young people and so on, but I don't want to say a number because I'll offend some of you that are, you know, older, but I'm sure it was way over 50. And why would they want to hire a 30-something-year-old? I was underaged. So you can see all of my excuses of being underage and undereducated and underqualified and underconfident, they were all reasonable. From a human perspective, I probably wasn't the best choice. But you know, God loves to take the little we have, and when we combine it with the greatness of who he is, he does stuff. And I've learned along the process that the moment you understand that you can't do it is the exact moment you're in the right posture to do it. You know, the moment you think, I can't, I'm in over my head, is the moment you're in the correct posture to do it. And why, that's a confusing statement. How does that make sense? Here's why, because when you realize that you can't do it on your own, you're in the right posture to have God do it through you. When you finally realize, I can't do this, God. Like the disciples realized, Jesus, we can't feed 5,000. And Jesus said, watch, but I want you to bring what you have. He said, this is the best we can do. We stole it from a kid. He said, watch. Watch me do something great. The disciples never could have fed 5,000 on their own. But you know they did. They distributed the food. They found the 5 loaves and 2 fish. They collected the 12 basketfuls afterwards. But God did the miracle, didn't he? You know, in a sense, God did it through them. You know, I felt inadequate as a lead pastor. I felt inadequate to preach. I didn't think I had enough material for a month of messages. Now, I've been preaching a few years, and God keeps providing, multiplying even. Some of you think maybe too much. God should take the leftovers back. I preach a little long. I don't know, but God has provided. Here's the thing. Don't think you need to bring a lot to God. Don't think you need to bring a lot to God. Simply bring all of who you are. Don't think you need to bring a lot or have some great ability. Bring all of who you are and then watch God work. Because God loves to combine the little we have and multiply it. You know, the big things that God does ought not to build pride in us. You know, the big things that God does sometimes through us should cause us to say, you know, humble us and give great thanks to who God is. Because the truth is, God doesn't need us. God doesn't need you. He doesn't need the 5 loaves and 2 fish that you can get. You know, he doesn't need you. Here's the amazing piece of who God is and his amazing love and grace is when he combines, when he brings us along the mission, we're going to do it imperfectly. And he says, come with me. Come join me. And he doesn't need the little we have, but he wants us. He says, I want you to be in communion with me, but I want you to be in mission with me too. You know, God exchanges his I for a we. And it's all his grace because he doesn't need us. We desperately need him, but he doesn't need us. You know, sometimes we're tempted maybe to boast about our own gifts and our own abilities. And we say, look what I accomplished. We're tempted to boast about our 5 loaves and 2 fish. You know, the whole thing was on us. Jesus, you know, Jesus could have never done that miracle if we disciples hadn't have found those 5 loaves and 2 fish. Come on. He doesn't need your 5 loaves and 2 fish. He fed 5,000 people with them. He didn't need your 5 loaves and 2 fish. The amazing grace of God is that he invites us. His love is that he invites us to join him. And so we ought not ever to boast about the great things he accomplishes. No one left that hillside that day saying, wow, did you see how the disciples distributed that food? Wow, that was amazing. No, they said, wow, can you believe what Jesus did? And the disciples sat back and said, no way. And Jesus said, you do it. You do it. So what about you? What's God calling you to? What do you feel prompted sometimes to do? And it causes some anxiety, or someone's even brought something to you and it's caused a little, oh, I don't think I can do that. You know, more times than not, God will look at you and say, why don't you do it? And our excuses are, can't you find someone else? And God says, yeah, I found someone else. Someone else is you. You do it. You know, maybe you see poverty and you think, someone needs to do something about this poverty. And God's looking at you and saying, yeah, so why don't you do something about it? And you have your excuses of not having enough money or not enough influence or not enough connections. And God says, why don't you just go and see what you can find and tie it in with who I am? You know, maybe you see an injustice at work or around school or in the world and you think, someone needs to stop it. And God's looking at you and saying, yeah, why don't you stop it? You know, maybe you see brokenness in families or marriages or addiction and people living without hope. You think something needs to be done and God's saying, why don't you do something? You do it. Pull them out of addiction. Pull them out of their mess. Give them some hope. You do it. You know, there's 11 or 12,000 people right here in our county, under our nose, right, our neighbors. I imagine at least 8,000 of them still need to have the hope that Christ gives us. That's a lot of people. I'm pretty sure God is looking at us and saying, why don't you do something about it? You do it. I don't have much. Then just bring all of who you are, as little as it is. Tie it in with who God is. What's God calling you to? Like me, I imagine, and like the disciples, I imagine you have your own throne of excuses. You're probably a king or queen as well. What can any of us do with the great need in front of us? God, what could I do? I'm just so small. It'd be like feeding 5,000 people. And we have our excuses. I'm too young. I'm too old. I'm not educated enough. I'm not influential enough. I'm not good at speaking. I'm just a woman. I'm just a man. I just can't. I just can't. I just can't. And God will say to you, just as he did to the disciples, well, why don't you just bring what you can? And you do it. Combine the little you have with his greatness. You know, scripture is full of stories of people who punched way above their weight class. It's full of stories of men and women and even children who walked into situations and circumstances that were way above their pay grade and level of education and level of expertise. It's like God just loves to use our weakness to do great things through us. He loves to do great things through our inadequacies. I think it's because in our weakness, he's shown to be so strong. You know, the Apostle Paul once wrote that God's power is made perfect in weakness. And then to the Corinthian church, he would add, for when I am weak, then I'm strong. You know, when I'm weak, then I'm strong. But it's not me. There's something bigger than me that gives me strength. It's Jesus Christ in me. So what's your excuse? What's your weakness? Here's some names, and they have stories. of how God used them in their weakness. And if you don't recognize the name, I want you to jot it down. Jot down the name, Google it later, find where it's found in the Bible and read their story. If you don't think you have it, if you don't think you can have a make it more conversation or you can't share the good news of Jesus with someone because you aren't good at talking, look up the name Moses. If your excuse is that you're too young, look up the name Josiah, a king who's 8 years old. If your excuse is that you're too old, read about Abraham and Sarah. If you think that you're too great a sinner for God to ever use, look up the names Paul and David. If you think, I just don't have the strength, I'm not strong enough, look up the name Gideon. If you think that you're too great a failure, in fact, you failed God himself, look up the name Peter or Jonah. If you think you're only a woman, read the story of Deborah. If you think you're not experienced enough, read the story of David as a young boy. If you think that you're not smarter, in fact, you don't think you're smarter than a donkey, read the story of Balaam. He can use you. If you think you're not educated enough and there's nothing special about you, read the story of the disciples in the early church. Acts 4:13 tells us this, that when they is the religious leaders who had captured John and Peter, because John and Peter kept talking about Jesus and they didn't want them to keep talking about Jesus. So when they had captured him, they saw the courage of Peter and John and realized that these were unschooled, ordinary men. They were astonished and they took note that these men had been with Jesus. You know, if you think you're not influential enough, read the story of Daniel or Joseph, or read the list of names that Jesus, the list of names of men that Jesus called to be his own disciples, and tell me which one had position or power. And yet they, through them, the church was begun. And today, more than 1 billion people every Sunday gather in the name of Jesus. You know, it's like God just loves to take the little and multiply it. He loves to take the little we have, and he loves to do big things when we combine it with who he is. So what excuse do you have before the maker of the universe? You try and tell him you can't do it. I don't know if he'll agree with you. You know, none of us are great enough to do what God calls us to. That makes life interesting. It's part of the journey of faith. Let's be honest. Even in our greatest greatness, we still fall far short. We just got 5 loaves and 2 fish. God's power is made perfect in weakness. He loves to use the unsuspecting, the weak things, and display his mighty power. So where is the peace in all this? Remember I told you earlier that there's peace? Well, after Jesus does the miracle, the feeding of the 5,000, the very next thing that happens, Jesus tells his disciples, get in a boat, go across the lake. And he dismisses the crowd. Well, a storm arises, and these disciples are, well, again, in over their head. The storm is too great for them. And Jesus comes walking out on the water while they see a figure, and of course, nobody can walk on water, so they figure it's a ghost, because only ghosts can walk on water, and they're terrified. And Jesus says, no, take courage, it's I. And then he reveals who he is by calming the storm in their presence. And Mark tells us this, right after he calms a storm, he says this, they were completely amazed, for they had not understood about the loaves. Their hearts were hardened. Now, what does a storm have to do with loaves? It's bewildering. Why would Mark put this here? Here's what it has to do with it. If Jesus can feed 5,000 men, not including women and children, with 5 loaves and 2 fish, I'm pretty sure he can keep the disciples secure in a storm. They had forgotten about the loaves. And Jesus wanted to show them God is not a one-hit wonder. It's not like, oh, you did a miracle back then. And that's why he gave them 12 basketfuls, each individually, so years later they would think back and remember when God calls them to something that's greater than they're able. They would remember the loaves. So I want to encourage you. Would you remember the loaves? And would you combine whatever God's calling, whatever he's nudging you to, would you take that step of faith and see him do big things? Let's bow to pray. Father, thank you for your love. Your power and your love is displayed in this story, how Jesus, you included the disciples in the miracle. And you wanted to show your greatness, to allow them to trust you more, that they wouldn't forget about the loaves. And Father, I imagine in this room, there's some of us here this morning that we're not even sure about faith. We're not sure about you, Jesus. Why would we put our faith in you? Why would we step out towards you? And that's a big step, and that seems too scary. It feels like they're too inadequate. God, I pray for those people this morning that they would be reminded of your greatness and that they would take a step. And Father, I know there's others of us that have walked with you many years and yet you continue to call us maybe just a little beyond what we're comfortable with. And for some of us, there's a small thing and maybe to someone beside us, we'd say, oh, it seems so small, but it's a big thing for them. God, I pray that they would remember the loaves. And that they would take that step of faith of saying, I'll combine the little of who I am, as insignificant as it seems, but with the greatness of who you are.